like Esperanto. The enthusiast loves it for its architecture, but nobody else can even figure out how to start using it. At present, neural networking software falls into this category. Available since the 1980s, this software mimics the structure of the brain, actually programming itself through the use of feedback and rules to improve its performance against a given task. It is a terribly exciting technology because for the first time, it holds out the possibility that computers can teach themselves and develop solutions that no human programmer could design from scratch. Nonetheless, the software has shown little commercial success because there has not yet emerged a unique and compelling application that would drive its acceptance over other, more established alternatives. Another example of a product that fell through the crack between the innovators and the early adopters is desktop video conferencing. At numerous R&D labs, from Xerox to Intel to PictureTel to IBM, versions of this capability have surfaced throughout the 1990s, and the inventors who develop it swear by it. But nobody else does. It is not a bandwidth problem. It is a business process problem. Marketing groups keep on forecasting business situations where the application would be compelling. Loan application processing, customer service in general, executive communications. But the dogs keep on refusing to eat the dog food, and marketing teams keep getting, well, recycled. The market development problem in the case of both neural networking software and desktop video conferencing is this. With each of these exciting functional technologies, it has been possible to establish a working system and to get innovators to adopt it. But it has not as yet been possible to carry that success over to the early adopters. As we shall see in the next chapter, the key to winning over this segment is to show that the new technology enables some strategic leap forward, something never before possible, which has an intrinsic value and appeal to the non-technologist. This benefit is typically symbolized by a single, compelling application, the one thing that best captures the power and value of the new product. If the marketing effort is unable to find that compelling application, then market development stalls with the innovators, and the future of the product falls through the crack. The other crack. There is another crack in the bell curve of approximately equal magnitude that falls between the early majority and the late majority. By this point in the technology adoption lifecycle, the market is already well developed, and the technology product has been absorbed into the mainstream. The key issue now, transitioning from the early to the late majority, has to do with demands on the end user to be technologically competent. Simply put, the early majority is willing and able to become technologically competent where necessary. The late majority, much less so. When a product reaches this point in the market development, it must be made increasingly easier to adopt in order to continue being successful. If this does not occur, the transition to the late majority may well stall or never happen. Programmable VCRs are currently in this situation, as are high-end office copier systems, and a whole slew of telephones which offer call forwarding, three-way conferencing, or even just call transferring. How many times have you been on the phone and heard, or said, "Now, I may lose you when I hit the transfer button, so be sure to call back if I do." The problem is that for people who are not frequent users of the system, the protocols are simply too hard to remember. As a result, users do not use the features, and so companies in mature markets find it harder and harder to get paid for the R&D they have done because the end user cannot capture the benefit. Instead, they bemoan that the product has become a commodity, when in fact it is the experience of the product that has been commoditized. This truly is marketing's fault, particularly when companies have ceded marketing the right to redesign the user interface and thus control the user experience. Other examples of products in danger of falling through the crack between the early and late majority are scanners for adding images to PC presentations and desktop publishing software. The market leaders in these two areas, Hewlett-Packard and Adobe, respectively, have been quite successful in capturing the early majority, but their products still give conservatives in the late majority pause. And so these categories are in danger of stagnating, although neither market is in fact saturated. Discovering the chasm. The real news, however, is not the two cracks in the bell curve, the one between the innovators and the early adopters, the other between the early and late majority. No, the real news is the deep and dividing chasm that separates the early adopters from the early majority. This is by far the most formidable and unforgiving transition in the technology adoption lifecycle, and it is all the more dangerous because it typically goes unrecognized. The reason the transition can go unnoticed is that with both groups, the customer list and the size of the order can look the same. Typically, in either segment, you would see a list of Fortune 500 to Fortune 2000 customers making relatively large orders. Five figures for sure, more often six figures or even higher. But in fact, the basis for the sale, what has been promised implicitly or explicitly, and what must be delivered, is radically different. What the early adopter is buying, as we shall see in greater detail in Chapter 2, is some kind of change agent. By being the first to implement this change in their industry, the early adopters expect to get a jump on the competition, whether from lower product costs, faster time to market, more complete customer service, or some other comparable business advantage. They expect a radical discontinuity between the old ways and the new, and they are prepared to champion this cause against entrenched resistance. Being the first, they also are prepared to bear with the inevitable bugs and glitches that accompany any innovation just coming to market. By contrast, the early majority want to buy a productivity improvement for existing operations. They are looking to minimize the discontinuity with the old ways. They want evolution, not revolution. They want technology to enhance, not overthrow, the established ways of doing business. And above all, they do not want to debug somebody else's product. By the time they adopt it, they want it to work properly and to integrate appropriately with their existing technology base. This contrast just scratches the surface relative to the differences and incompatibilities among early adopters and the early majority. Let me just make two key points for now. Because of these incompatibilities, early adopters do not make good references for the early majority. And because of the early majority's concern not to disrupt their organizations, good references are critical to their buying decisions. So what we have here is a catch-22. The only suitable reference for an early majority customer, it turns out, is another member of the early majority. But no upstanding member of the early majority will buy without first having consulted with several suitable references. Bodies in the chasm. What happens in this catch-22 situation? First, because the product has caught on with the early adopters, it has gotten a lot of publicity. In networking, consider gigabit Ethernet, optical switching, cable modems, and digital subscriber loops. In PCs, voice processing for dictation, interoperability with television, and specialized devices like the electronic book. In peripherals, personal digital assistants for email and internet access, keyboards with built-in scanners, and table-free gyroscopic mice that operate in free space. in enterprise software, applications for data mining, target marketing, and end-to-end supply chain visibility. And on the internet itself, 3D worlds ginned up a VRML, IP telephony, and following that, IP video conferencing. We have all read a lot about these types of products, yet not one has achieved to date a mainstream market leadership position, despite the fact that the products actually do work reasonably well. In large part, this is because of the high degree of discontinuity implicit in their adoption by organizations, and the inability of the marketing effort to date to lower this barrier to the early majority. So the products languish, continuing to feed off the early adopter segment of the market, but unable to really take off and break through to the high-volume opportunities. The classic example of this scenario for the 1990s was client-server computing for enterprise applications. In 1987, it was proclaimed by the Gartner Group as the enterprise architecture for the coming decade. And indeed, every IT department genuflected in agreement. Every year thereafter, there would be articles about breakthroughs in client-server hardware, the arrival of mission-critical RDBMS software, new tools for GUI front-ends, but at the end of the day, all that sold was server-centric mainframe and mini-computer packages. It was not until 1992, 5 years into the making, that client-server finally emerged as a viable software category. And it wasn't until 1995, 8 years later, that it finally overtook its server-centric ancestor. Why so long? Client-server computing required, among other things, a standard client with GUI capabilities. In 1987, the standard client was a DOS computer. There were four graphical alternatives: Unix, Macintosh, OS 2, and Windows. The announced intent of IBM and Microsoft was to make OS 2 the replacement platform. But that floundered, and both Unix and Macintosh thrived, while Windows lagged. And so the whole market lagged, until finally Windows 3.0 emerged as the new de facto standard. At that time, PeopleSoft introduced its client-server package for human relations with Windows clients, and the market was launched. Let's look at another example. One of the great cover stories of the early 1980s was artificial intelligence, AI, brains in a box. Everybody was writing about it, and many prestigious customer organizations were jumping on the bandwagon of companies like TechKnowledge, Symbolics, and IntelliCorp. Indeed, the customer list of any one of these companies looked like a who's who of the Fortune 100. Early AI pioneers like Tom Keller, the chairman of IntelliCorp, routinely got coverage everywhere from Inc. and High Technology to Time magazine, to the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and among other things, were able to ride that wave of enthusiasm to take their companies public. Today, however, AI has been relegated to the trash heap. Despite the fact that it was, and is, a very hot technology, and that it garnered strong support from the early adopters, who saw its potential for using computers to aid human decision-making, it has simply never caught on as a product for the mainstream market. Why? When it came time for the early majority to absorb it into the mainstream, there were too many obstacles to its adoption. Lack of support for mainstream hardware, inability to integrate it easily into existing systems, no established design methodology, and a lack of people trained in how to implement it. So AI languished at the entrance to the mainstream for lack of a sustained marketing effort to lower the barriers to adoption. And after a while, it got a reputation as a failed attempt. And as soon as that happened, the term itself became taboo. So today, although the technology of AI is alive and kicking, Underlying such currently popular manifestations as so-called expert systems and object-oriented programming, no one uses the phrase artificial intelligence in their marketing efforts. And a company like IntelliCorp, which had struggled desperately to be profitable as an AI firm, has backed completely away from that identity. In sum, when promoters of high-tech products try to make the transition from a market base made up of visionary early adopters to penetrate the next adoption segment, the pragmatist early majority, they are effectively operating without a reference base and without a support base within a market that is highly reference-oriented and highly support-oriented. This is indeed a chasm, and into this chasm, many an unwary startup venture has fallen. Despite repeated instances of the chasm effect, however, high-tech marketing has yet to get this problem properly in focus. Indeed, that is the function of this book. As a final prelude to that effort, therefore, by way of evoking additional glimmers of recognition and understanding of this plight of the chasm, I offer the following parable as a kind of condensation of the entrepreneurial experience gone awry. A high-tech parable. In the first year of selling a product, most of it alpha and beta release, the emerging high-tech company expands its customer list to include some technology enthusiast innovators and one or two visionary early adopters. Everyone is pleased, and at the first annual Christmas party held on the company premises, plastic glasses and potluck canapés are held high. In the second year, the first year of true product, the company wins over several more visionary early adopters, including a handful of truly major deals. Revenue meets plan, and everyone is convinced it is time to ramp up, especially the venture capitalists who note that next year's plan calls for a 300% increase in revenue. What could justify such a number? The technology adoption profile, of course. For are we not just at that point in the profile where the slope is increasing at its fastest point? We don't want to lose market share at this critical juncture to some competitor. We must act while we are still within our window of opportunity. Strike while the iron is hot. This year, the company Christmas party is held at a fine hotel. The glasses are crystal, the wine vintage, and the theme, a la Dickens, is Great Expectations. At the beginning of the third year, a major sales force expansion is undertaken. Impressive sales collateral and advertising are underwritten, district offices are opened, and customer support is strengthened. Halfway through the year, however, sales revenues are disappointing. A few more companies have come on board, but only after a prolonged sales struggle and significant compromise on price. The number of sales overall is far fewer than expected, and growth in expenses is vastly outdistancing growth in income. In the meantime, R&D is badly bogged down with several special projects committed to in the early contracts with the original customers. Meetings are held, for the young organization is nothing if not participative in its management style. The salespeople complain that there are great holes in the product line, and that what is available today is overpriced, full of bugs, and not what the customer wants. The engineers claim they have met spec and schedule for every major release, at which point the customer support staff merely groan. Executive managers lament that the sales force doesn't call high enough in the prospect organization, lacks the ability to communicate the vision, and simply isn't aggressive enough. Nothing is resolved, and offline political enclaves begin to form. Third quarter revenues results are in, and they are absolutely dismal. It is time to whip the slaves. The board and the venture capitalists start in on the founders and the president, who in turn put the screws to the vice president of sales, who passes it on to the troops in the trenches. Turnover follows. The vice president of marketing is fired. It's time to bring in real management. More financing is required, with horrendous dilution for the initial cadre of investors, especially the founders and the key technical staff. One or more founders object, but are shunted aside. 6 months pass. Real management doesn't do any better. Key defections occur. Time to bring in consultants. More turnover. What we really need now, investors decide, is a turnaround artist. Layoffs followed by more turnover. And so it goes. When the screen fades to the credits, yet another venture rides off to join the twilight companies of Silicon Valley. Enterprises on life support, not truly alive, and yet, due in part to the vagaries of venture capital accounting, unable to choose death with dignity. Now, it is possible that this parable overstates the case. I've been accused of such things in the past. But there is no overstating the case that year in and year out, hundreds of high-tech startups, despite having good technology and exciting products, and despite initial promising returns from the market, falter and then fail. Here's why. What the company staff interpreted as a ramp in sales leading smoothly up the curve was in fact an initial blip, what we will be calling the early market, and not the first indications of an emerging mainstream market. The company failed because its managers were unable to recognize that there is something fundamentally different between a sale to an early adopter and a sale to the early majority, even when the company name on the check reads the same. Thus, at a time of greatest peril, when the company was just entering the chasm, its leaders held high expectations rather than modest ones, and spent heavily in expansion projects rather than husbanding resources. All this is the result of high-tech marketing illusion, the belief induced by the high-tech marketing model that new markets unfold in a continuous and smooth way. In order to avoid the perils of the chasm, we need to achieve a new state, high-tech marketing enlightenment, by going deeper into the dynamics of the technology adoption lifecycle to correct the flaws in the model and provide a secure basis for marketing strategy development. 2. High-tech marketing enlightenment. First, there is a mountain. Then there is no mountain. Then there is. Zen proverb. What is it about California? How can any state be so successful economically and yet so weird? I myself am from Oregon, a perfectly normal state, with a pleasantly thriving economy and plenty of fishermen and lumberjacks and such to balance out the high-tech crazies. I never intended to move south and write a book that says, in the very next paragraph, mind you, that you should bet your next million on a Zen proverb. California is a bad influence. However, if you are going to risk time and money in high-tech, then you really do need to remember how high-tech markets develop, and the following proverb is as good a way as any. First, there is a market, made up of innovators and early adopters. It is an early market, flush with enthusiasm and vision, and often as not, funded by a pot full of dollars earmarked for accomplishing some grand strategic goal. Then there is no market. This is the chasm period, during which the early market is still trying to digest its ambitious projects, and the mainstream market waits to see if anything good will come of them. Then there is. If all goes well, and the product and your company pass through the chasm period intact, then a mainstream market does emerge, made up of the early and the late majority. With them comes the real opportunity for wealth and growth. To reap the rewards of the mainstream market, Your marketing strategy must successfully respond to all three of these stages. In each case, the key to success is to focus in on the dominant adoption type in the current phase of the market. Learn to appreciate that type of person's psychographics, and then adjust your marketing strategy and tactics accordingly. Illustrating how to do that is the goal of this chapter. First principles. Before we get started, however, we need to establish some ground rules. The first step toward enlightenment is to get a firm grasp on the obvious. In our case, that means getting a useful working definition of the word marketing. Useful in this context means actionable. Can we find in the concept of marketing a reasonable basis for taking actions that will predictably and positively affect company revenues? That, after all, is the purpose of this book. Actually, in this context, defining marketing is not particularly difficult. It simply means taking actions to create, grow, maintain, or defend markets. What a market is, we will get to in a moment. But it is, first, a real thing, independent of any one individual's actions. Marketing's purpose, therefore, is to develop and shape something that is real, and not, as people sometimes want to believe, to create illusions. In other words, we are dealing with a discipline more akin to gardening or sculpting than, say, to spray painting or hypnotism. Of course, talking this way about marketing merely throws the burden of definition onto market, which we will define, for the purposes of high tech, as a set of actual or potential customers for a given set of products or services who have a common set of needs or wants and who reference each other when making a buying decision. People intuitively understand every part of this definition except the last. Unfortunately, getting the last part, a notion that part of what defines a high-tech market, is the tendency of its members to reference each other when making buying decisions, is absolutely key to successful high-tech marketing. So let's make this as clear as possible. If two people buy the same product for the same reason, but have no way they could reference each other, they are not part of the same market. That is, if I sell an oscilloscope for monitoring heartbeats to a doctor in Boston, and the identical product for the same purpose to a doctor in Zaire, and these two doctors have no reasonable basis for communicating with each other, then I am dealing in two different markets. Similarly, if I sell an oscilloscope to a doctor in Boston and then go next door and sell the same product to an engineer working on a sonar device, I am also dealing in two different markets. In both cases, the reason we have separate markets is because the customers could not have referenced each other. Depending on what day of the week it is, this idea seems to be either blindingly obvious or doubtful at best. Staying with the example at hand, can't one argue that there is, after all, such a thing as the oscilloscope market? Well, yes and no. If you want to use the word market in this sense, it stands for the aggregate sales, both past and projected, for oscilloscopes. If that is how you want to use the word, say, if you are a financial analyst, that's fine. But you had better realize you are adding apples and oranges, that is, doctor sales plus engineer sales, to get your final totals. And in so doing, you are leaving yourself open to misinterpreting the data badly. Most importantly, market, when it is defined in this sense, ceases to be a single, isolable object of action. It no longer refers to any single entity that can be acted on, and cannot, therefore, be the focus of marketing. The way around this problem for many marketing professionals is to break up the market into isolable market segments. Market segments, in this vocabulary, meet our definition of markets, including the self-referencing aspect. When marketing consultants sell market segmentation studies, all they are actually doing is breaking out the natural market boundaries within an aggregate of current and potential sales. Marketing professionals insist on market segmentation because they know no meaningful marketing program can be implemented across a set of customers who do not reference each other. The reason for this is simply leverage. No company can afford to pay for every marketing contact made. Every program must rely on some ongoing chain reaction effects, what is usually called word of mouth. The more self-referencing the market, and the more tightly bounded its communications channels, the greater the opportunity for such effects. So much for first principles. There are additional elements to our final definition of market, principally a concept called the whole product, but we will get to that later in the book. For now, let's apply what we have to the three phases of high-tech marketing. The first of these is the early market. Early markets. The initial customers set for a new technology product is made up primarily of innovators and early adopters. In a high-tech industry, the innovators are better known as technology enthusiasts or just techies, whereas the early adopters are the visionaries. It is the latter group, the visionaries, who dominate the buying decisions in this market. But it is the technology enthusiasts who are first to realize the potential in the new product. High-tech marketing, therefore, begins with the techies. Innovators, the technology enthusiasts. Classically, the first people to adopt any new technology are those who appreciate the technology for its own sake. For readers old enough to have been raised on Donald Duck comic books from Walt Disney, Gyro Gearloose may well have been your first encounter with a technology enthusiast. Or, if you were more classically educated, perhaps it was Archimedes crying, "Eureka!" at discovering the concept of measuring specific gravity through the displacement of water. Or Daedalus inventing a labyrinth and then the wings whereby one could fly out of it, if one did not fly too close to the sun. Or, for those who turn more toward movies and TV, more familiar examples of the type include Back to the Future's Doc Brown, or the professor from Gilligan's Island. Inventors, propeller heads, nerds, techies. We have many labels for a group of people who are, as a rule, and despite a tendency toward introversion, delightful companions, provided you like to talk about technical topics. They are the ones who first appreciate the architecture of your product, and why it therefore has a competitive advantage over the current crop of products established in the marketplace. They are the ones who will spend hours trying to get products to work that in all conscience never should have been shipped in the first place. They will forgive ghastly documentation, horrendously slow performance, ludicrous omissions in functionality, and bizarrely obtuse methods of invoking some needed function, all in the name of moving technology forward. They make great critics because they truly care. To give some high-tech examples, technology enthusiasts are the ones who buy HD TVs, DVD players, and digital cameras when they each cost well over $1,000. They are interested in voice synthesis and voice recognition, interactive multimedia systems, neural networks, the modeling of chaos in Mandelbrot sets, and the notion of an artificial life based on silicon. At the moment I am writing this sentence, they are on the internet at an MP3 site downloading songs to play on a Diamond R10 playback machine. Sometimes a technology enthusiast becomes famous, usually as the inventor of a lucrative product. In the world of PCs, Bill Gates started business life this way, but he may have fortified his status somewhat as he became more Machiavellian. Marc Andreessen, on the other hand, has tried to stay more in a role, although he too is looking more and more corporate. That could not be said, on the other hand, of such internet founding stalwarts as Larry Wall, the inventor of Perl, Apache co-founder Brian Behlendorf, or Linux creator Linus Torvalds. Birkenstocks forever, man. Power to the people. Oops. Sorry. I'm having a 60s flashback. My personal favorite, though, is a fellow named David Lichtman, with whom I worked at Rand Information Systems in the late 70s and early 80s. Long before anyone was taking PCs seriously, David showed me one he had put together himself, including, as a peripheral, a voice synthesizer. This was sitting on his desk at work, right next to a little microprocessor-driven box he had invented to fill out his timesheet for him. If you followed David home, you would find a house littered with cameras, sound equipment, and assorted electronic toys. And at work, whenever there was any question about how a particularly arcane or intricate tool actually functioned, David was the man to ask. He was the archetypal technology enthusiast. In business, technology enthusiasts are the gatekeepers for any new technology. They are the ones who have the interest to learn about it and the ones everyone else deems competent to do the early evaluation. As such, they are the first key to any high-tech marketing effort. As a buying population, or as key influences in corporate buying decisions, technology enthusiasts pose fewer requirements than any other group in the adoption profile, but you must not ignore the issues that are important to them. First, and most crucially, they want the truth, and without any tricks. Second, whenever possible, whenever they have a technical problem, they want access to the most technically knowledgeable person to answer it. Often this may not be sound from a management point of view, and you will have to deny or restrict such access. But you should never forget that it is wanted. Third, they want to be first to get the new stuff. By working with them under non-disclosure, a commitment to which they typically adhere scrupulously, you can get great feedback early in the design cycle and begin building a supporter who will influence buyers not only in his own company, but elsewhere in the marketplace as well. Finally, they want everything cheap. This is sometimes a matter of budgets, but it is more fundamentally a problem of perception. They think all technology should be free or available at cost, and they have no use for added value arguments. The key consequence here is, if it is their money, you have to make it available cheap. And if it is not, you have to make sure price is not their concern. In large companies, technology enthusiasts can most often be found in the Advanced Technology Group, or some such congregation, chartered with keeping the company abreast of the latest developments in high tech. There they are empowered to buy one of almost anything, simply to explore its properties and examine its usefulness to the corporation. In smaller companies, which do not have such budgetary luxuries, the technology enthusiast may well be the design techie in the MIS group, or a member of a product design team who either will design your product in or supply it to the rest of the team as a technology aid or tool. To reach technology enthusiasts, you need to place your message in one of their various haunts. On the web, of course. Direct response advertising works well with this group, as they are the segment most likely to send for literature, or a free demo, or whatever you offer. Finally, don't waste your time with a lot of fancy image advertising. They read all that as just marketing hype. Direct email will reach them. And provided it is factual and new information, they read cover to cover. In sum, technology enthusiasts are easy to do business with, provided you, 1, have the latest and greatest technology, and 2, don't need to make much money. For any innovation, there will always be a small class of these enthusiasts who will want to try it out just to see if it works. For the most part, these people are not powerful enough to dictate the buying decisions of others, nor do they represent a significant market in themselves. What they represent instead is a beachhead, a source of initial product or service references, and as a testbed for introducing modifications to the product or service until it is thoroughly debugged. In Search of Excellence, for example, Peters and Waterman tell the story of the fellow who invented Post-it notes. He just put them on the desk of secretaries, and some of those secretaries just tried them to see if or how they would work. Those secretaries became Post-it note enthusiasts, and were an early key in the campaign to keep the product idea alive. Enthusiasts are like kindling. They help start the fire. They need to be cherished for that. The way to cherish them is to let them in on the secret, to let them play with the product and give you the feedback, and wherever appropriate, to implement the improvements they suggest, and to let them know that you implemented them. The other key to working with enthusiasts toward a successful marketing campaign is to find the ones who are near or have access to the big boss. Big bosses are people who can dictate purchases and who do represent a significant marketing opportunity in and of themselves. To get more specific about the kind of big boss we are looking for, let us now turn to the next group in the technology adoption lifecycle, the early adopters, or as they are often called in the high-tech industry, the visionaries. Early adopters, the visionaries. Visionaries are that rare breed of people who have the insight to match an emerging technology to a strategic opportunity, the temperament to translate that insight into a high-visibility, high-risk project, and the charisma to get the rest of their organization to buy into that project. They are the early adopters of high-tech products. Often working with budgets in the multiple millions of dollars, they represent a hidden source of venture capital that funds high-technology business. When John F. Kennedy launched the U.S. space program, he showed himself to be something we in America had not known for some time, a visionary president. When Henry T. Ford implemented factory-line mass production of automobiles so that every family in America could afford one, he became one of our best-known business visionaries. When Steve Jobs took the Xerox PARC interface out of the laboratory and put it into a personal computer for the rest of us, then drove the rest of the PC industry to accept this computer almost in spite of itself, he showed himself to be a visionary to be reckoned with. As a class, visionaries tend to be recent entrants to the executive ranks, highly motivated and driven by a dream. The core of the dream is a business goal, not a technology goal, and it involves taking a quantum leap forward in how business is conducted in their industry or by their customers. It also involves a high degree of personal recognition and reward. Understand their dream, and you will understand how to market to them. To give additional examples specific to high tech, when Sheldon Laub at Price Waterhouse committed to purchase and install 10,000 copies of Lotus's new and totally unproven product, Notes, he was acting as a visionary. When Pete Salvik, CIO at Cisco, drove all the customer service and order processing systems to the internet, abandoning client-server computing even before it had reached its peak, he was acting as a visionary. When Jim Barksdale at Federal Express opened up their customer service systems to self-service, first via a PC, then via the web, he was acting as a visionary. In every case, these people took significant business risks with what at the time was unproven technology in order to achieve breakthrough improvements in productivity and customer service. And that is the key point. Visionaries are not looking for an improvement. They are looking for a fundamental breakthrough. Technology is important, only in so much as it promises to deliver on this dream. If the dream is cell phone usage anywhere, then the system will involve a matrix of low Earth orbit satellites, such as Iridium or Teledesic. If it is one-on-one marketing, then the technology will include data mining of transaction processing databases, such as that provided by BM's Intelligent Miner. If it is an inventory-less supply chain, then it will include advanced planning, forecasting, and replenishment algorithms combined to intercompany systems integration, as companies like Manugistics and i2 bring to market. If it is eliminating the paperwork nightmare of agent-based insurance sales, then it will include self-service technology from the internet and legacy systems integration, such as ChannelPoint is introducing. The key point is that, in contrast with a technology enthusiast, a visionary derives value not from a system's technology itself, but from the strategic leap forward it enables. Visionaries drive the high-tech industry because they see the potential for an order of magnitude return on investment and willingly take high risks to pursue that goal. They will work with vendors who have little or no funding, with products that start life as little more than a diagram on a whiteboard, and with technology gurus who bear a disconcerting resemblance to Rasputin. They know they are going outside the mainstream, and they accept that as part of the price you pay when trying to leapfrog the competition. Because they see such vast potential for the technology they have in mind, they are the least price-sensitive of any segment of the technology adoption profile. They typically have budgets that let them allocate generous amounts toward the implementation of a strategic initiative. This means they can usually provide upfront money to seed additional development that supports their project. Hence, their importance as a source of high-tech development capital. Finally, beyond fueling the industry with dollars, visionaries are also effective at alerting the business community to pertinent technology advances. Outgoing and ambitious as a group, they are usually more than willing to serve as highly visible references, thereby drawing the attention of the business press and additional customers to small fledgling enterprises. As a buying group, visionaries are easy to sell, but very hard to please. This is because they are buying a dream, which, to some degree, will always be a dream. The incarnation of this dream will require the melding of numerous technologies, many of which will be immature or even non-existent at the beginning of the project. The odds against everything falling into place without a hitch are astronomical. Nonetheless, both the buyer and the seller can build successfully on two key principles. First, visionaries like a project orientation. They want to start out with a pilot project, which makes sense because they are going where no man has gone before, and you are going with them. This is followed by more project work conducted in phases with milestones and the like. The visionary's idea is to be able to stay very close to the development train to make sure it is going in the right direction and to be able to get off if they discover it is not going where they thought. While reasonable from the customer's point of view, this project orientation is usually at odds with the entrepreneurial vendors who are trying to create a more universally applicable product around which they can build a multi-customer business. This potentially lose-lose situation, threatening both the quality of the vendor's work and the fabric of the relationship, requires careful account management, including frequent contact at the executive level. The winning strategy is built around the entrepreneur being able to productize the deliverables from each phase of the visionary project. That is, whereas for the visionary, the deliverables of phase one are only of marginal interest. Proof of concept with some productivity improvement gained, but not the vision. These same deliverables, repackaged, can be a whole product to someone with less ambitious goals. For example, a company might be developing a comprehensive object-oriented software toolkit capable of building systems that could model the entire workings of a manufacturing plant, thereby creating an order of magnitude improvement in scheduling and processing efficiency. The first deliverable of the toolkit might be a model of just one milling machine's operations and its environment. The visionary looks at that model as a milestone. But the vendor of that milling machine might look at the same model as a very desirable product and want to license it with only modest alterations. It is important, therefore, in creating the phases of the visionary's project, to build in milestones that lend themselves to this sort of product spin-off. The other key quality of visionaries is that they are in a hurry. They see the future in terms of windows of opportunity, and they see those windows closing. As a result, they tend to exert deadline pressures, the carrot of a big payment or the stick of a penalty clause, to drive the project faster. This plays into the classic weaknesses of entrepreneurs: lust after the big score and overconfidence in their ability to execute within any given time frame. Here again, account management and executive restraint are crucial. The goal should be to package each of the phases such that each phase, 1, is accomplishable by mere mortals working in Earth time, 2, provides the vendor with a marketable product, 3, provides the customer with a concrete return on investment that can be celebrated as a major step forward. The last point is crucial. Getting closure with visionaries is next to impossible. Expectations derived from dreams simply cannot be met. This is not to devalue the dream, for without it, there would be no directing force to drive progress of any sort. What is important is to celebrate continually the tangible and partial as both useful things in their own right, and as heralds of the new order to come. The most important principle stemming from all this is the emphasis on management of expectations. Because controlling expectations is so crucial, the only practical way to do business with visionaries is through a small, top-level direct sales force. At the front end of the sales cycle, you need such a group to understand the visionary's goals and give them confidence that your company can step up to them. In the middle of the sales cycle, you need to be extremely flexible about commitments as you begin to adapt to the visionary's agenda. At the end, you need to be very careful in negotiations, keeping the spark of the vision alive without committing to tasks that are unachievable within the time frame allotted. All this implies a mature and sophisticated representative working on your behalf. In terms of prospecting for visionaries, they are not likely to have a particular job title, except that, to be truly useful, they must have achieved at least a vice presidential level in order to have the clout to fund their visions. In fact, in terms of communications, typically you don't find them, they find you. The way they find you, interestingly enough, is by maintaining relationships with technology enthusiasts. That is one of the reasons why it is so important to capture the technology enthusiast segment. In sum, visionaries represent an opportunity early in a product's life cycle to generate a burst of revenue and gain exceptional visibility. The opportunity comes with a price tag, a highly demanding customer who will seek to influence your company's priorities directly, and a high-risk project that could end in disappointment for all. But without this boost, many high-tech products cannot make it to market, unable to gain the visibility they need within their window of opportunity, or unable to sustain their financial obligations while waiting for their marketplace to develop more slowly. Visionaries are the ones who give high-tech companies their first big break. It is hard to plan for them in marketing programs, but it is even harder to plan without them. The dynamics of early markets. To get an early market started requires an entrepreneurial company with a breakthrough technology product that enables a new and compelling application. A technology enthusiast who can evaluate and appreciate the superiority of the product over current alternatives. And a well-heeled visionary who can foresee an order of magnitude improvement from implementing the new application. When the market is unfolding as it should, the entrepreneurial company seeds the technology enthusiast community with early copies of its product, while at the same time sharing its vision with the visionary executives. It then invites the visionary executives to check with the technology enthusiast of their choice to verify that the vision is indeed achievable. Out of these conversations comes a series of negotiations in which, for what seems like a very large amount of money at the time, but which will later be recognized as just the tip of the iceberg, the technology enthusiasts get to buy more toys than they have ever dreamed of. The entrepreneurial company commits itself to product modifications and system integration services it never intended to, and the visionary has what on paper looks to be an achievable project, but which is in fact a highly improbable dream. That's when the market unfolds as it should. That is the good scenario. Good because, although it is rife with problems, they are ones that will get solved one way or another, and some level of value will be achieved all around. There are numerous other scenarios where the early market does not even get a proper start. Here are some of them. First problem. The company simply has no expertise in bringing a product to market. It raises insufficient capital for the effort, hires inexperienced sales and marketing people, tries to sell the product through an inappropriate channel of distribution, promotes in the wrong places and in the wrong ways, and in general, fouls things up. Remedying this kind of situation is not as hard as it may seem, provided the participants in the company are still communicating and cooperating with each other, and everyone is willing to scale back their expectations several notches. The basis for reform is the principle that winning at marketing, more often than not, means being the biggest fish in the pond. If we are very small, then we must search out a very small pond indeed. To qualify as a real pond, as we also noted before, its members must be aware of themselves as a group. That is, it must constitute a self-referencing market segment, so that when we establish a leadership position with some of its members, they will get the word out quickly and economically to the rest. Of course, no single pond of a size we can dominate in the short term is large enough to provide a sustaining market for the long term. Sooner or later, we have to go pond hopping. Or, to shift the metaphor, we need to reframe our pond tactics in the context of a bowling pin strategy, where one targets a given segment not just because one can knock it over, but because, in so doing, it will help knock over the next target segment, and thus lead to market expansion. With the right kind of angle of attack, it is amazing how large and fast the chain reaction can be. So one is never necessarily out of the game, even when things are pretty bleak. A second problem. The company sells the visionary before it has the product. This is a version of the famous vaporware problem, based on pre-announcing and pre-marketing a product that still has significant development hurdles to overcome. At best, The entrepreneurial company secures a few pilot projects, but as schedules continue to slip, the visionary's position in the organization weakens, and support for the project is eventually withdrawn, despite a lot of customized